And so these all are surfaces, they're all a piece of paper, they're all two-dimensional. But what's different, well, I mean, these two are different because we know this has two sides and this only has one. The other thing that I haven't said anything about is, so is this different from, well, this is, I think this has two twists. No, that has no twists. I can fix that. The one over there.
Okay, now
I've made it with two twists. Okay, and the question is, are those the same? Or are they different? And they both have two sides. They both have an inside and an outside. And it turns out that these are the same. You can write down a homeomorphism, one of the stronger sense of the same. And the homeomorphism isn't too hard to write down. I just sort of travel along this one, and I travel along this one, and when I get to the scene, well, I glue them with the arrows pointing in the same way, and so that is a homeomorphism. What's different about them is how they're sitting in three-dimensional space. So there's not just the question of what dimension is this object, but also how does it sit in space. And that does turn out to be an important question. So some of the things that topologists try to quantify are these two things the same, or in what ways are they the same, in which ways are they different? And one of the things that you can quantify, you could ask also, for example, if you have two of these cylinders, two of these just items, cylinders linked together, is that the same or different from having two of them that are separate? And somehow a topologist doesn't really care whether they're linked around each other or not, because they're sort of two separate pieces and we can treat them separately. But if we care about how they're sitting in three dimensions, how they're sitting in space, then yes, they are different, and there are sort of more, okay, so what we've talked about so far is not enough to quantify the difference between them, but there are tools, and those tools are getting to what research mathematicians think about. There are tools that can distinguish those two things.
I've heard topology is useful in solving optimization problems. Is that right?
I could believe that, yes. So here's a way in which I think that topology has been used, applied relatively recently. So I said that a topological space was just a set of points, together with an idea of how close various points are to each other, or which points are close to each other. So here's a topological space. The topological space I want to describe is the set of all lines sitting in three dimensions. So here's one, here's another one. This one is close to that one because they're close to each other. Okay, so the points here are not points, but there's lines, and then I can talk about how close they are to each other. Okay, so a more complicated one would be, well, suppose I want to have a whole bunch of lines that are connected to each other, say a line that's this long and then a line that's this long, and I can ask about all of the different possible configurations, and they're sort of close to each other if you can just wiggle them to get from one to the other. And that is a topological space. It has some very nice structure, and it also has very important geometric meaning, and it has importance in robotics. You want to talk about what are the different possible configurations of a robot arm, and you want to study how to get from this configuration to this configuration so that the robot can pick up something and then move back. And there are tools in topology that are used to study how you move around in a space. And so how you would move around in the space of all configurations of an arm and how to do that optimally. And so that's one way in which topology has been used for optimization, optimizing robot paths across a room or robot trajectories, so on and so forth, satellite settings.
I can answer a question from earlier. I cut up the cross with two levers. If the two loops are both just sit the same way, they come separate as yours did. And if they're just a different way, they're joined.
Excellent.
So by the same way, you did clockwise versus anti-clockwise, didn't you, for the second one?
Clockwise versus anti-clockwise are the same.
The last one.
Yeah.
Seychelles.
Well done.
Well, cheating.
Well.
Cheating. There's no way I would have talked to seashells.
I would never have gotten seashells.
Or you could.
Some of the questionable ones include Caribbean islands like St. Kitts and Nevis. Do you write out or do you? Okay.
What are the other kind of real-world applications of topology?
So another, there's been some recent work in topology in data analysis. So when you're trying, so there's all this buzz about big data. And one of the things you might try to do, so if you have a big data set, it means that you have, say, a big Excel spreadsheet that has a bunch of different items and they have a bunch of different attributes. And so you have a lot of rows and columns. And say you have 100 rows, and each, 100 rows, 1,000 rows, 1,000,000 rows with 1,000,000 different attributes. Each row sort of represents one point, and each attribute tells you sort of maybe where it is in some million dimensional space. Okay, so you have some points floating around in, well, if there were just three attributes, they would be in three dimensions, but there are many, many. But what you want to know is you sort of have this cloud of points, and one of the things topologists have been doing is trying to understand. So I said that we try to quantify things about surfaces or about other shapes, and they've been trying to develop techniques to not just sort of continuous spaces, but discrete spaces where I just have these sets of points, and I can somehow see which ones are close to each other. I can sort of imagine the shape that they're if I have enough points, the clouds are making up the points are making up a cloudy shape, and there are tools to tell you something about the features of that shape, what kind of holes it has, what kind of, you know, essential holes, like a donut has that essential hole in the middle. And is it sort of, you know, you have these points in million-dimensional space, but do they really happen to be all lying on a two-dimensional thing, which would be much easier to understand? So that's another recent application, and there's a topologist in Stanford who has a startup that somehow makes money out of this. I don't quite understand.
And I've wanted to ask a mathematician this for years, how is somebody like me meant to think about dimensions? Because my head starts going screwy as soon as I get past 3 plus time.
Yeah, I don't think past 3 dimensions. I mean, of course, the truth is that the work that I do is in a field called symplectic geometry. And it's a field where you have something that's essentially two-dimensional, some essentially two-dimensional structure. And what it means is that the dimensions you're working in are always even-dimensional because you have this special two-dimensional thing that's singled out. And it basically means for me that I can picture the two-dimensional examples. I have the surface of the Earth, I have the surface of a bagel, and then once they're higher dimensional, you can't picture it exactly in the same way. You have other tools, you have other descriptions where you can sort of think a little bit about the geometry, but it's very hard to think about pictures exactly in your head. Although sometimes I will say that there are certain features of the space that cast shadows. So one of the ways that we understand, say, something three-dimensional is it casts a shadow on the ground by the sun, and so you can maybe understand something about the space from the shadow that it casts or the various different shadows that it casts.
Yeah.
So maybe that's one.
When you rotate three dimensions.
Right, it casts, you can see the...
Yeah, I'm sort of wondering about the forces. I'm wondering about the forces involved. You only got tension here and in your universe picture, and you've got tension from gravity. Isn't there some suggestion that dark matter is involved in repulsion? I mean, with tension, you've got an end.
Mm.
You've got a tweeny little one, that's it.
Mm.
With repulsion, you don't have an end. But I can't think anymore.
I will say that reminds me of a very interesting... So this other public lecture I gave, which I'm happy to talk about at another time if people are interested in, was about origami, about folding paper, and the geometry that you can create doing that. But this your comment about forces reminded me, it was thought that you could only ever fold a piece of paper in half 7 times. That's the folk nod. But in fact, that's not true. If you take a very long piece of loo roll It turns out it's possible to fold it in half and fold it in half. So if you start with a strip of paper and you always fold in the same direction, then in fact, you can fold many more times than that. And so there, at MIT, there's something called the infinite corridor, which is this very long hallway because the buildings are all connected. And it's a long, straight hallway. And on certain days of the year, the sun setting shines through the infinite corridor. And on other days of the year, the students get a very long piece of loo roll and fold it up. I think they've got it 14 or 15 times. I mean, it's on, okay. Far beats 7. I don't know what practical application that has, but mathematicians are often unconcerned that they can see their practical application.
Very good one.
Yes.
The comment
very absorbent.
The comment about the universe made me think, does topology have anything to kind of talk about in terms of the bending of space?
Well, so someone once asked me to draw a picture where you sort of had a picture of all of the different fields of mathematics and drew connections where there are connections. And of course, what you end up with is just, you know, you have all of the things and then everything is connected to everything because there's you can almost always find a connection. And certainly you can, there are lots of connections. Whether or not they tell you very much, I don't know. I mean, you could try to imagine how gravity somehow affects the shape of space. I mean, somehow you can quantify how the forces interact. More likely, I would say that you should use, there's a field of mathematics called differential geometry, where you're, so in geometry, you're much more careful about how things are curving. And that's the kind of thing that you worry about when you're wondering about the shape of space. And so that would be more the answer I would give. However, there is a beautiful video by someone called Jeff Weeks called The Shape of Space. You can find it on the internet, at least clips of it, and I recommend watching it. It shows you very viscerally pictures of how so in geometry there are these there are different kinds of geometry, and it shows you very viscerally how you would detect. So for example, if we were living on a one-dimensional thing, how would we know if we were on a circle? How would we know if we were on a circle? How would we know if we were on a circle? It would keep repeating. And so if you're in a three-dimensional thing, how do you know if you're going around and ending up back in the same place? And so I recommend going to look at that.
Hang on a second, just behind you first, then we'll come back.
Can I ask sort of the inverse of those questions about, you know, what the links are outwards and what the applications are? So where did topology come from? What was the driver for developing this set of ideas at all? I mean, I know where, like, how algebra came out of geometry, but where did this come out of and why?
I don't know. Do you know a good answer for that?
Just one area and differential equation.
That's not a good answer.
Will? Will?
Was Leonhard Euler involved with topology? I know it was with graph theory, but maybe it's also topology?
You can probably see some facets of topology. I mean, certainly Euler in his, there's this, did he use anything about this Königsberg bridge problem?
Yeah.
And so somehow saying that he had this, there's a question in Königsberg, there's a certain configuration. There's a river, there are a couple of islands, and there are various bridges between the islands. And so the question is, can you traverse all of the bridges exactly once? And the answer is no. The reason is that we can think of this problem. So this problem is really on the surface of the Earth. We can really, what's essential about it is the bridges, and we can contract all of the land masses to just points. And so we just have these points connected by bridges, and then it becomes a question in graph theory. And so implicit, there's this idea that you can squish or contract what's really unnecessary about a problem. And certainly in ideas in topology have come up in mathematics, in analysis and geometry. I mean, somehow, well, I don't know a good answer, I guess. But I mean, many of these ideas, many of the types of things, sort of topology had really began to flourish, I think, in the mid 20th century. and exactly why. I think because there were some very beautiful connections discovered between topology and algebra, and between topology and geometry. I think that's why any particular field flourishes at a particular time in mathematics is when new connections are discovered, and you're able to use tools from one field to tell you something interesting about another field.
Sorry, it's a bit of a trivial question, but to which I should know the answer. Is there any topological difference between galaxies? Elliptical, spiral,
galaxies. No idea. I in theory should know some physics, but I embarrassingly don't.
Do you want to, Will, just in front of you?
Oh. With the prime bottle, where it goes round, as it were, and re-enters the cross of the circle, is there a mathematical discontinuity there that you, as topologists, allow for?
Well, so what a topologist would say is that's sort of a three-dimensional shadow of a prime bottle. And so just as when you have a shadow of yourself, and say if you do it, something funny and your leg lands on top, you can't see everything. And so the fact that it intersects itself is exactly evidence that this is really a shadow of the thing that we're looking at. And if you really had such an object, it shouldn't intersect itself. And so in three dimensions, the best we can do is some shadow like this where it overlaps itself. Yes, you can buy one, and what happens in the one that you buy is that there's actually a hole where it crosses through itself, and so you can actually pass liquid through. So it's a nice three-dimensional shadow of the mind bottle is what it should really be called. But
from what you're saying, if you start with your piece of paper,
yeah,
or whatever you're going to make your Klein bottle out of, then by making a hole through which you can pass, you're changing it, aren't you?
Exactly, okay. Exactly.
Good, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Behind you all.
We haven't mentioned helices at all, which is of interest biologically, but I mean, what can you see what say about the topology of helices?
So there is so
spiral.
Yeah, So one way a helix comes up is this. One way in which topologists try to understand spaces that are not contractible. So things like a circle. A circle we know is not contractible. One way that we try to understand spaces like that is to find spaces that are contractible, that are almost homeomorphic to the thing that we're looking at, but there may be... I need to draw a picture here. But they're what's called locally homeomorphic. And so... So the picture is this. There are spaces called covering spaces where I have something downstairs that I want to understand. Say it looks like a disk. And then upstairs, so everything upstairs maps to my disk in a way that looks like a homeomorphism, in a way that looks like it's an exact match, except it might happen a few times. So there might be a disk up here. It might happen sort of three times. And then somehow these three disks fit into my bigger structure in some interesting way. And so the way that a helix fits in to this picture is that, this is going to be very hard to draw, if the space that I'm interested in studying is a disk with a hole taken out of the center. Oh, I hope I'm getting this right.
Is it a spring?
And so then what is going to be my covering space of this is exactly a spring. And there's a hole through the middle, a helix, and it's sort of lying exactly over this, twisting around.
Yeah.
And a helix is contractible, so that's and so So it's what is called a covering space, and this connection I was talking about between topology and algebra exactly relates the topology of this bigger space and the smaller space to something in algebra, which, you know, is topology or algebra harder? I don't know. They answer different questions.
But in those children's models of springs,
yeah,
they collapse, don't they?
Exactly.
Into a sort of cylinder.
Exactly. And that's exactly how you think of these covering spaces.
A helix space.
What you were doing earlier when you were making the linked Möbius strips was basically using nets. So a net to turn into. Do you know what I'm. Maybe it's an English school word. So a net being something flat from which you can construct a three dimensional thing by folding it up. So you make a net of a box. So you have.
Oh. I've never heard that term.
Okay.
No.
What's
yeah,
something
no,
like,
I've heard that.
Is there a better term?
Yeah.
Yes, like the unfolded version of the box.
Okay.
So are there any kind of topological rules about how the unfolded version of things turn into the folded version?
Not general. I'm sure there are questions. I'm sure there are interesting questions to ask, and I'm sure some of them have been answered, but I don't have any good answers.
It's all right. Anything else from anybody?
If a surface is infinitely squishable and extendable, does that still allow you to have the word close?
Yeah, well, so I sort of lied when I told you that was the definition of couple. But the answer is yes. So when you're thinking about this infinite squishing or stretching or whatever, what you can do is take any space. There's a way of sort of defining the minimal thing that it could possibly squish to, and then that's where you really study the topology. So a cylinder. A cylinder, the really minimal thing, the important thing about it is that it has this hole. I could really squish it so that it's really just a circle, and that's the minimal thing. And so there is a notion, if two things are homotopy equivalent, there's sort of the minimal thing that they both squish to. And this notion of minimal thing, that's where you would really talk about closeness, if that makes sense.
I think you've got everybody absolutely gobsmacked. I think what we might do is just stop here kind of formally. But we're going to be clear out for a while, and I have a hunch that maybe people who want to have a go at things or ask a bit more of time. So please don't rush out at all. And obviously I'd like to say thank you to the museum for allowing us to use their space. Thank you very much to my glamorous helpers tonight and as always. Thank you very much to all of you for coming. Next month's cafe will be Carol Hill from Nottingham, who's going to talk about the differences between horse or equine and human vision, and the implications that has for managing and training horses. So that's one to end with. We then take a break in August. We'll be then back in September, October, November on the second Tuesday of the month. And I have left out the flyers on the little bench behind here, so that if you want to take down the website and go and sign up to our mailing list, you're very, very welcome. But the biggest of thank yous to Tara, who did this at relatively short notice, and absolutely fantastic. Thank you. Thank you.